This is a Squiz podcast. We're your shortcut to being informed. G'day, I'm Kate Watson, and this is News Club, the place to go for conversations about the news. This week, our News Club was on perspectives on the gender pay gap. Jamila Rizvi is the Deputy Managing Director of Future Women, a social commentator, a public speaker. You are a lot of things, Jamila. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start by asking you just a couple of questions about yourself. If someone said to you, Jamila, who are you? What would you say?
Yeah, is it bad that I hate the question of who are you? Because I never quite know what to say first, because I'm someone, I think, who defines myself very much by the people I'm around. So I define myself by relationships first. And yet to say I'm a mother and a wife feels very anti-feminist somehow. And yet for me, you know, they're the two big relationships of my life, right? Mm. That's what dominates most of my waking hours, is spending time with my partner and my son. If I try and answer it like the conventional way, I suppose, I think I'm someone who's doing a whole bunch of work in the gender equality space, because that's something that's really important to me, particularly in workplaces. And I'm doing that in a whole lot of different ways.
To be honest, that's one of the things I really admire about you. I've watched your career for a really long time. You do live and breathe this every day in what you do, and this topic every day. Can I start by asking you a little bit about the bubble that you're in? You do this day in, day out. You talk about this day in, day out. How do you get outside your bubble and see other perspectives?
Well, interestingly, I'm now paid to get outside my bubble, because the work that we do at FW or Future Women, part of what we do now includes training men, and it includes training men in organizations that are struggling with their gender pay gaps, that are struggling to recruit women, that are struggling to get women to come to the table. And so we run a program called Changemakers, where we are going into organizations, and organizations as diverse as policing, the army, manufacturing, as well as, you know, the public service, the ASX 300. And we are talking directly with leaders, including men, about gender inequality. And you get the full range of responses. Mm. You get the guys there who are so eager to show you that they know everything already.
That's interesting.
They're super woke and they've got the equality down pat, which is lovely. And then you get a small percentage who sit there with their arms crossed and don't want to be there and don't know why you're there, and who are not afraid to tell you that everything you're saying they think is rubbish. Mm-hmm. And then you get the kind of 90% who are in the middle, who are a bit of a mix of thinking, yeah, this sounds important, but aren't things not so bad anymore? Much better than they were for my grandmother, right? And they genuinely want to do the right thing by their women colleagues, but don't really know how to go about it.
I know women have very different perspectives also.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have really enjoyed being part of that training, because when you're talking about gender and you're talking about anything, I suppose, with a degree of specialization, the people you talk to about it are necessarily in that little bubble with you, right? And so you have to actually be quite deliberate in taking yourself outside of it.
Gender pay gap, it's what I got you here for. There was an explosion of news about this last week, of course, with those WGEA numbers coming out.
Sure was.
These numbers, of course, were published for the first time. They looked at company by company, the median pay gap for those with more than 100 employees. Half of the reporting employers have a gender pay gap of over 9.1%. A handful have over 50%. Top line, your take on the data. Was it what you expected?
Largely, yes, I think it was what I expected. And to be honest, I think the response was what I expected as well, in that we had a whole lot of employers who were on the wrong side of the data coming out and talking about equal pay as opposed to pay equality, which is what we're measuring with the gender pay gap data. For me, it's exciting that we're collecting this data. It's exciting that we're publishing it. I am more excited about this point next year than I am about this point this year, because I think now we've got a baseline and we've got a public baseline. I'm not surprised, for example, that, you know, the banking industry, the construction industry, the mining industries have bigger gender pay gaps than sort of more social services industries, right? I think we all would have expected that to a degree. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is how quickly they're going to be able to shift it and how much those organizations really put a focus on it and want to make change.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair point. I think I automatically go to, okay, what's the solve here? What are the factors that are contributing to this? I think we can pretty much summarize them into three things, which is that, as you point out, one, women are working in lower paid industries.
Yeah.
The other being that women are taking on the caring role. The other being outright discrimination.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, which of those do you consider the most problematic or hardest to shift, hardest to move?
Wow. I'm really struggling to answer that because I feel like they're all difficult to shift. So Australia has one of the most gender segregated workforces in the OECD, which means that most Australians work in a workplace or an industry that is dominated by men or dominated by women. We don't have many industries where it's kind of roughly equal numbers. So as soon as you've got that being the case, the gender pay gap becomes more complex. The caring piece comes in there, and the time spent at home and the time out of paid work. And so you don't have women reaching the higher echelons and the higher paid jobs in organizations in the same numbers. Importantly, though, in male-dominated industries, the women in those industries tend to be paid less. And in female-dominated industries, the men in those industries tend to be paid more. If you think about your local primary school, a lot of us went to a primary school, for example, where we had a bunch of women teachers the whole way through, but the principal and the deputy principal were men.
Yeah, it's, I mean, layers and layers, right? And that is why it is a really difficult question to answer. And I can imagine being a policymaker in this space would be quite challenging.
Yeah.
We asked our audience, the Squeeze audience, what they thought the primary reason was and what they thought, you know, sort of was the problematic reason. They said the caring role.
Yeah.
That was their response. It was quite close, but it's probably a good place to start. There's a couple of things that have been cited for some time as potential barriers to changing this and to shifting this. One being parental leave entitlements for both parents, the other being childcare. We know the reason a gap exists is because a lot of women move to part-time work after having children, right?
Well, at the moment, we have more generous childcare subsidies than we've ever had, right? Childcare is more available than it ever has been. Doesn't mean it's available and accessible for everyone, but it is more available than it ever has been. But we still have subsidies that incentivize women to work part-time. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that that childcare subsidy starts to drop means that working one day, 2 day, 3 days a week makes a lot of sense. But the marginal benefit of that extra fourth day or that extra fifth day starts to get pretty low, if not even into the negatives. And I think most heterosexual couples will look at the cost of childcare and the cost of the extra parent working, and they consider the childcare the cost of the woman in the household working.
One of the things that came up when Katie Gallagher announced this Wajir data, she's still with Mary Waldridge, they talked a little bit about quotas and getting more women into senior roles. I noticed that Mary Waldridge jumped in and said, well, that's great, but we can't just be pulling from the same pool of women. We can't have the same senior women moving across companies. We need to grow the pipeline. Yeah. The way the subsidy is set up seems to disincentivize high-income women to go back to work in a big way, in a large way.
Yeah, I think so. I think part of the complexity here is the way we think about early childhood education and childcare as a policy area. Mm. Over the last sort of two decades, we've really focused in on the importance of early education for children. We know that 95% of humans' brain development happens in those first 5 years. And so it's worth intervening then and investing in education. I think a byproduct of that investment and that magnifying glass that we've put on early education, though, is we've stopped talking about childcare as much as an enabler of women's participation. And so if an investment in childcare by government is about creating a level playing field for kids to learn, then more of that money needs to go to low-income families where those kids perhaps aren't getting the same educational opportunities in the home or otherwise. But if you put a women's participation lens on it, you want all women participating in the workforce, regardless of what their family income is. And it's not unusual. I'm sure we all know people in our lives where you've got a couple where dad earns a very considerable income. And so the household income is very, very high, but mum's only been working 1 or 1.5 days a week for 5, 6, 10 years, right? Because she's been doing most of the unpaid work in that household. Now, I think there's a question to ask there of whether or not it's worth government investing more into her childcare and making that possible.
One of the observations that was made by some of our audience members, and I'd seen it in the commentary, is that is the solution forcing families, forcing is probably too strong a word, to have two incomes? And we are talking about, you know, families with two parents. There's a whole nother group of people and other groups of people, but
yeah,
that is assuming that both parents want to work, that both parents are comfortable with that. Is there something in thinking about the caring role and the unpaid caring role from a policy point of view in a different way?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I suppose the way I look at that is you go back to my parents' generation. My parents are, I think, sort of the youngest year of the baby boomers. They just make it into boomer territory. You know, they grew up in a generation where when my mum wasn't working around the time my sister and I were young, it was still manageable to have a mortgage. That wasn't putting them in, you know, housing stress.
Exactly.
Now our lives, particularly housing, but more generally, are built around the assumption that you've got two incomes to pay for it. And I've watched friend after friend after friend going onto parental leave and going, oh my gosh, how are we going to get through this? How long can I take off? How quickly do I have to get back, right? So ideally, would we have a situation where the average household only needed one average income to be able to survive and have a roof over their head and have a comfortable life? 100%. Because then that couple could break up paid and unpaid work as they wanted to. And that's a place of genuine choice, right?
Yeah.
But we've actually built a system where most families do need two incomes to survive. And as a result, when we've got women taking all of that unpaid work time and not having access to superannuation payments, for example, then you've got women retiring into poverty later in life. And because it's so gendered, it means we're just screwing women over later in life.
It's a really good point. And I like this conversation because it's relevant to all of us. It's the conversation that demonstrates that this is not about women working. This is about how we want society to be and how we want society to look. And you hear this all the time. And you, as you said, in your friendship groups and from our audience, well, I mean, there isn't a choice here. We both have to work. So why is it made so difficult? Do you see a shift in the amount of men who are willing to stay at home and take on the caring role? Do you think that's changing?
I think the number of men who are willing to stay at home and take on the caring role for a short period is changing. I don't think we're seeing a significant statistical shift beyond that. There are, you know, there are always exceptions to that rule, absolutely. And I'm sure that if we looked at the numbers closely, we'd see there are more men, for example, taking extended parental leave than there were 10 years ago, but not in a significant way. I think those cultural expectations of what mum's supposed to do and what's dad's supposed to do are so deeply ingrained. Mm. I know so many couples who would have bragged about how gender equal their relationships were until kids come into the mix. And it's not like anyone did anything malicious. It's not like they sat down and went, all right, you're going to stay home, I'm going back to work. Ha ha. There's none of that. They set up their family and their circumstances in the way that seemed most sensible at the time. Because I think it's very common for women who've had a child to want to stay home for that first 6 to 12 months. That's pretty standard, right? I think what we need to do from a policy level is try and de-gender the policy piece as much as possible, and where we can start to create some incentives that suggest to parents that in the early stages of their children's life, the more equal they can make things, the better. Because I do think you set in train what's going to happen for the rest of that child's life. Whereas if dad's away and is never doing the majority parenting for the first 5 years, pretty hard to expect him to start to do it after that, because everyone's found their niche and everyone's comfortable.
This is, it's interesting. And I mean, we've got so much to talk about, so I do want to move on. But one of the club picks we recommended this week was the Janet Albrechtson piece, the opinion piece in the Weekend Papers, which I'm sure you would have read. A hugely emotional piece of writing. I'm sure you have views on Janet Albrechtson generally, but for a lot of mums reading that piece, that would have struck a chord. That this idea that, you know, I chose to stay home. I wanted to. If my partner had tried to make that call and stay home with my kids, I would have said, no way, I want to do this. But I appreciate what you're saying in that it's actually just more about the choice than the want or the desire.
And at the moment we make our choices within a particular set of structures that suggests we make one choice over the other. Genuine choice is just removing those structures so that if that is what you want to do, you are able to do that and you're financially supported to do that. And I've certainly got friends who've had that experience and who said, I'm going to take 3 months parental leave and be straight back, and then went, oh my God, never.
I'm
never going back to work. I don't want to, right? And I think our challenge as an economy needs to be, how do we create something that allows for that choice and also validates that choice? Because I do think we need to be cautious about devaluing parenting and devaluing caring. And doing the function of unpaid work, you know, raising the next generation is important.
We're on the same page as there is something in unpaid care and valuing unpaid care. And I know you've written quite a bit about that. One of the things that changed a lot, obviously during the pandemic, was this ability to work from home. I know future women is entirely a work from home workplace. There are plenty of jobs. My job's very flexible in what I'm able to do. But when you look at those industries that where the pay is much lower, that are dominated by women, a lot of those, and I mean, one of the solutions to some of these problems has been this suggestion around flexibility in the workplace. A lot of those jobs, though, you can't do flexibly. You have to go to work. You have to go and do those jobs. I know Jeff Kennett last year suggested that maybe we should be paying people less who work from home. And this was a very controversial opinion at the time, but it got me thinking about, if we are going to prioritize flexibility, are we really increasing this class divide in industry? And are women actually going to benefit from that?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think even when you think about, you know, office workers who, for the most part, could work flexibly if their employers were into the idea, I worry about us creating a bit of a class system in office work where you've got women at home working flexibly, out of sight, out of mind, and you've got men. Like, do you create a new boys' club of men who have the flexibility to go into the office because they don't have the same unpaid caring responsibilities? Mm. I don't know. You know, I think of the benefits of having that physical face time with senior people, your boss's boss's boss, because you walk past one another, I don't know, outside the water cooler or whatever
it is,
that you can't get at home. You're not going to have that unless you're actually in a meeting together, and that's going to be unlikely. But I think you're right. I think we've got some big questions as a country around how we value work that is, you know, what we called essential during the pandemic, which was very female dominated. You certainly had essential work that men were doing as well, but for the most part, you were talking about. I will never forget. I'm in Melbourne, and I remember it was the front page of The Age after one of the horrible early days when then there was an infection breakout and we had to send people in hazmat suits to do the cleanup. And there was this picture of on the front page of The Age of these two women of Southeast Asian background in these hazmat suits going in to do the cleanup, going in where absolutely nobody else would go in, and just thinking, yeah, of course. That's who it is. And I bet we're not paying them very well, and they're absolutely doing the job that no one else will do right now, but they're doing the job of keeping everyone else safe. So I do think we've got some sort of questions to ask ourselves there. From a policy perspective, how do you do it? It's tricky because childcare and aged care are difficult business models, right? Really difficult business models. And so you haven't necessarily got business owners who are making giant profit margins all the time. Some of the bigger organizations, absolutely, but some of the smaller companies that are running that kind of work are not necessarily making huge bank on it, right? How do you encourage them to pay more fairly? How do you encourage them to meet the kind of standards that we're asking for their employees? I think that becomes more complex when you've got industries where the different employers as players are in such varied positions.
Yeah, and how do you not assume that flexible working is an option for everyone in how you set things up, because that for so many people that's just not possible. So it's not an option to reduce this gender pay gap. It's not an option to be able to go and pick your kids up at 3 o'clock. It's not an option to be able to do the 9 a.m. drop off or whatever it is. The boys' club. Do you think it's rife still? Do you think it still exists? Do you think it's improving? What's your experience?
I do think there's been a shift in the sort of post-Me Too world. I do think there's been a shift because I think there's a greater awareness amongst a whole lot of men who perhaps would have been sideline or bystander players in a boys' club but are now quite determined to not be part of it or not be seen to be part of it. And so I think there's a bit of a breakdown there. I think you've also got employers who are more conscious of the risks of, you know, alcohol in the workplace and creating a whole lot of assumptions that potentially are going to make it easier for some than others to participate in social activities and the like. But yeah, it still exists. I don't think it's disappeared. I just think we made a little dent in the last 5 or 6 years.
That's interesting. And I mean, you're kind of in one of those jobs where you hope it doesn't need to exist anymore, aren't you? Like that's kind of
the goal. Well, I feel like I've exited the space at a personal level. I've just gotten out of there by, you know, I've spent almost a decade now working in women's media or in now in an ed tech company that's supporting mostly women, or talking to men about gender equality. So at a personal level, I've exited the space, but my background was in working in politics before that. And I talk to friends who are still in that space who say, yeah, definitely better, but the better is said in this very loaded way.
Whenever you ask about the boys' club, I feel like there's a personal story that every woman tells about their experience of that.
Yeah.
But I do hope that it's shifting, although we did see Matt Canavan say this week that the Wajir data is a driver to Andrew Tate. I'm sure you have views on that comment. This is one of our most prominent politicians.
Yeah. Look, I don't have a lot of time for Matt Canavan and his particular views. I am someone who works pretty hard to make sure I spend some time reading and thinking outside my political bubble. If I can give the most generous possible reading to that comment, I think we do have a bit of a conversation to have as a country about how progressive some views are, regardless of your politics, around gender, and how stuck in the past others are, and how what that means for the way we do business and the way we work together and the way the economy and our society runs. And in particular, I think there's a real challenge for us in schools and in education. I think we've got a schooling system where girls are outdoing boys on every single NAPLAN outcome in every single school year until I think it's year 9 maths and science, the boys suddenly get ahead of the girls. But you've got these kids growing up in environments where the girls are dominating, and yet they're getting an education that is so focused on gender inequality that suggests that women struggle to get ahead, right? And these are kids who haven't hit the workforce yet. And so I do think you've got a whole bunch of boys and teenage boys who are feeling frustrated with the educational system and the setting, and are kind of questioning and going, what are you talking about? I don't see any of that inequality. If anything, the girls seem to get a better run. They're winning all the awards and they're getting all the good marks, right?
They're going to uni, they're getting the degrees.
Yeah. And so I do think we've got some questions there about if our education system is benefiting boys in the best way, if we need to look at greater flexibility, if we need to look at different learning styles, because learning styles are gendered. You know, I think we've got some questions there, because you can't just teach kids about inequality that they don't see, and just assume by the time they get to the workforce, oh, they'll figure it out then, because you will breed a degree of discontentment and a degree of resentment. And I do think we need to be cautious there. I'm not sure that's what Matt Canavan meant, but that's going to be my take, my positive take.
I think this is something we do together, men and women. 100%. We walk hand in hand in this. It has to be understood by both parties. And I guess it brings me really neatly to what my final question for you was going to be, which is, what does Australia look like if we don't have a gender pay gap in your eyes? What are we aiming for here?
I suppose we're aiming for a place where, regardless of gender, we are retiring comfortably, and we are retiring with a knowledge that we will be secure when we are no longer working. It means that we are looking at workforces where, when you ask a kid to draw a picture of a firefighter and you ask a kid to draw a picture of a nurse, there'll be a mix of genders. It means a country where kids are being raised by wonderful parental role models, regardless of gender, and where you've got people who are moving into retirement, and you have women who are financially secure, and you have men who don't say, I'm spending more time with my grandkids than I ever got to spend with my kids, and mourning that fact. Like, I think we do need to lean into the fact that gender equality is not just about women. It benefits everyone. Gender equality means genuine freedom of choice to pursue what you want. And I look at my own dad and the delight he has in hanging out with my son, and my memories of dad as a kid are mostly dad being at work, or, you know, being quickly dropped somewhere before he had to get somewhere. And I don't think he ever really thought about or mourned what he was losing at the time, but I think he does now, because he sees what he didn't get. And he looks at my husband, for example, who is very much an equal parent, and goes, oh, wow, that would have been kind of nice.
Yeah. And this is the thing, I think, thinking about it being a bit different and looking different to what your experience was, whatever age you might be, but being, and I like how you've put it with that education piece, being cognizant that you don't want to overcorrect.
Yeah.
I think is really important. Jamila, I could talk to you all day about this. There's so much to unpack, and I'm sure we'll get you on again, but thank you for doing this. I know you're having a very busy week.
Oh, thanks, Kate. It was a pleasure.
If you're interested in the work of Future Women, as I said, a link is in your episode notes. News Club is the place to go for conversations about the news. Join Claire and I on the Weekly Wrap tomorrow. It's the week in news and what's coming up. And then our News Club topic next week will be Meta's beef with news. If you don't know what I'm talking about, tune in. We've got this.